Welcome, people.
Hey,
Surefire. Surefire Sessions, episode 3.
Episode 3, here
we
are.
Can you believe it?
I can believe it, and this is a really, really special one for me.
I'm Dave Springer.
I'm Joe DiMeo.
Today in the studio, we have the man, the myth, the legend, the man who started Yasgur's Farm. The man who is Yasgur's Farm, let's just say that. He is Yasgur's Farm.
Yeah.
Mr. Lenny Molinari.
Woo!
Lenny!
Hello!
Great to have you, my friend, my man.
Lenny's never done a podcast before, so he tells me.
That's right.
That's your first one?
First one.
You ever listened to one before? Or?
No.
No? Okay. Very cool. We're going to talk to Lenny about a lot of stuff. He's been around for a while. He's got a lot of stories, a lot of stuff to talk about. He brought his notes, which is good. We love when people have notes.
Well, that means you got some history here.
That's right.
That's right. You know, so
let's start at the beginning, Lenny. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up, started in Newark.
Okay.
I lived there till I was 13 years old. Then I moved to Bloomfield. Mm-hmm. I stayed in Bloomfield until I got married. I was 28 when I got married.
That's a good age.
Yeah, well, I was trying to make it. You know, I was trying to make it. I was with the same girl. I met my wife when I was 15 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I was on the road quite a bit right away, and she lived home with her mom, and we saved our money until we were able to put a down payment on a house. And that sort of determined when we were going to get married.
Right,
and
right.
It took that long.
But you finally did.
Yeah, we got married. We're still married. 2 children, 2 grandchildren.
God bless. That's amazing.
How many years?
I've been with her for close to 60 years, but we got married 47 years ago.
47 years
ago. All right, so you know, getting ready for the big 5-0, that's a big one.
Yeah, I think I was
5 years old when that happened, I think, or something like that.
And I love her like you can't believe to this day.
That's amazing.
She's
that's a great love story.
Woman. Yeah. Wonderful woman.
Where did you guys meet?
We met in school, junior high school.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's quite a story, but I think it's a long story.
That's another podcast?
For another podcast.
You told me that one. That's a
take
great
up a
one.
Whole hour.
You told me that story before. That's
I
a great
did.
Story, yeah.
Yeah.
I love that story. So,
When did you realize music was your thing? How old were you?
I was about 13. Well, actually, I was about 10 when my parents took us to Seaside Heights. Mm-hmm. We went there every year for a week or two. And this one year we went, and we were on the boardwalk during the day going onto the beach, and we walked past the chatterbox. Mm-hmm. And in the chatterbox, there was a band playing, a rock and roll band. Right. Now, you got to remember, this is 1955 or 54.
Wow.
You never heard a live rock and roll band before that. I never did.
Right.
And specifically, I never heard an electric guitar before. The first time I heard an electric guitar, it was a tremendous experience.
Blew your mind.
It just stopped me dead in my tracks.
Yeah.
It was so spooky and bad sounding and cool.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to go on the beach. I sat, they let me sit there. I put my back to the wall at the beachcomber there, and I sat there all day listening to one band after another playing and just was mesmerized by the sound of that guitar. And my course was set. From that moment.
You knew it.
I knew. This is what I want to do.
Wow. What kind of tunes were they doing back then? I guess some Elvis, right? They must have been
playing. They were doing some Elvis. They were doing like Bill Black and Bill Doggett, you know, Honky Tonk. And it's hard to remember,
right, with
the blue suede shoes, that kind of stuff, you know.
Wow.
But I really liked it. I liked the organ kind of bluesy rock sound, you know, that Honky Tonk Part 2 and... also the sax stuff I liked, you know, Night Train, all cool sounding stuff, you know. Right. It wasn't so much the white version of rock and roll that I was attracted to. It was more the black version of it, you know.
Well, most
it
of
was
the bands,
bluesier.
Right? Yeah. I mean, Stones and Beatles, I mean, they were all influenced by all that stuff, weren't they?
I think we all have those similar roots, you know.
That's
so
awesome.
When did you pick the guitar up then?
Well, I begged my parents for a guitar from that minute on. But when I was 6, they bought me an accordion. I wanted a guitar when I was six. Yeah. You know, and I never heard an electric guitar, even heard one on the radio, but I figured I'd get just like a Roy Rogers kind of guitar on, because I liked it. Yeah. But they put me an accordion, and I hated the accordion. I hated it. I wouldn't practice. I didn't want to play it. So they thought the same thing was going to happen with a guitar,
right.
And that's what they threw up to me. And I said, but I never wanted it. Finally, they bought me a guitar when I was 13. And that's when I started.
Oh, okay.
And from that minute, I went in my room. I wouldn't go out with my friends anymore. All I did was sit in my room and play the guitar. That's
yourself?
All I wanted to do. I taught myself in the beginning. Uh-huh. Took a couple of lessons, and I don't know if whether the teachers were, you know, they were old school kind of teachers, want to teach you to read Little Brown Jug and that kind of stuff. And I wanted to play Guitar Boogie Shuffle.
Mel Bay one, although there probably wasn't a Mel Bay back then, right?
Yeah, the Mel Bay book one. That's right. They start. But then in high school, I took they had a college course in music theory and harmony course.
Oh, okay.
And I really learned everything I know practically. Technically about music in that course. That really opened up music for me. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it was hearing, seeing, and practicing.
Sure, sure. That was what college was that?
It was a college course, but it was in Bloomfield High School that they offered it.
Gotcha. Oh, that's cool. In high school, you got to take that, huh? That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I was the only guy in the class that didn't read.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I flunked it the first semester, and I aced it the next semester.
Got it down.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's awesome. What was your first band?
My first band was called The Youngsters.
Oh.
Yeah, appropriately so.
Right.
We were just two guitars.
Yeah. Wow.
Then we added a drummer. Then we added a sax player and a bass player and, believe it or not, an accordion player, because nobody had a keyboard that they could carry around, right. You know, so we had an accordion player.
So that was the emulation.
I'm sorry?
That was the emulation.
Yes, that's right. And I remember our first rehearsal, everybody played the same thing, the same notes. You know, we played honky tonk, and everybody was going da 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 da. There's something wrong about this. It doesn't sound right.
You got to start somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah,
oh, that's very cool.
Great story.
Joe was telling me about Salvation.
Yes.
Was this a super group or something? That's what I saw.
I guess if you can have a super cover band, I would say that, yeah, we were number one in the tri-state area. And at that time, if you were number one in the tri-state area, you were probably number one in the world.
Right, right.
You know? But my career really started way before Salvation. I had done a lot more accomplished things. Most people around here only know me from Salvation on.
Okay.
But I was signed to two or three different record companies before that.
Okay.
I was in a New York City band that was voted the hottest New York City band back in the 60s, and we signed with Atlantic.
Let's talk about that. What was that?
Let me go back a little bit.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I started with the Youngsters, then it became Lenny and the Continentals, and from there it became the Varmints, and at that point, I was already working five nights a week. I was like 16, 17 years old, and my dad was driving me to gigs. And I was making more money than my dad, believe it or not. I was working five nights a week.
Yeah,
He was driving. My dad was a bus driver, and he'd go to work every morning, bleary-eyed, but he'd still take me and practically all the guys and all the equipment in his big Chrysler, you know, everything fit in there. From there, I went to a band called the Varmints, and that was a traveling band. We went on the road 40 weeks a year. And in those days, you played clubs six nights a week, same club. And when I think back about those days and the bands from those days, those bands were unbelievably better than the bands you find playing cover music today. Mm-hmm. And the reason was you were always together. the clubs were open in the afternoon, not to the public, just to clean up and stuff. And we had a chance to go in the clubs and rehearse every day. And when you're on the road, you know, there's nowhere to go. You don't know anybody. You only have a truck to get you around.
Sure.
So we would be in the clubs every day rehearsing and getting it tighter and putting arrangements and doing endings and harmonies tight and making sure every harmony stopped on the whatever beat of the bar that it all should stop on.
Right.
And that's sort of where I sowed my oats, you know, touring like that in those bars on the road all over the, yeah. all over the country. And then from there, Mark Allen from the biggest talent agency, Premier Talent. He saw us in the city once, and he loved us. And he said, you know, the only thing you're lacking is a great singer. And he introduced us to this guy named John D. Robertus. Mm-hmm. John D. Robertus was and is, if he's still alive, to this day, the greatest singer I've ever heard. And anybody that ever heard him, hands down, thought he was the greatest singer they ever heard. And he was the key to opening a lot of doors. Yeah. He got us a contract with Fat Frankie Scanlaro, who owned the Vagrants, which was Leslie West's band.
Oh, okay.
And he was affiliated with the Rascals, and Felix Cavalier became our producer, and we signed with Atlantic Records. And unfortunately, as the world turns, three of the guys in the band were doing naughty things, and they all got hepatitis.
Oh, ouch.
One after another.
Yeah.
One after another. And this is when we first were going into the studio to record. Yeah. One guy got it. He's out for 6 weeks. During that time, another guy got it. He's out. And then another guy got it. By that time, I was disgusted. I didn't like what was going on. I was not into any kind of drugs or anything, and I just didn't think the other three guys were from the city, and they had a different lifestyle.
Right.
Anyway, I left the band and started an all-original band. Now, this is going into 69.
Okay.
And that band was called Sioux, like the Indian name Sioux.
Okay.
And we were an all-original band, and that band became pretty accomplished. We were playing at the Electric Factory in New York City, and a guy named Shelley Finkel saw us. Shelley was a big time mover in Manhattan. He owned one of the biggest, when they had the World Soccer League, he owned the United States World Soccer team.
Right.
He also now owns Mike Tyson, or did when Mike Tyson was a big star.
Okay.
So he arranged for a showcase for the band, and with his influence, he got everybody that was anybody to this club called Ongano's, which was the hippest club in the city back then.
Right.
It was that in the scene. And
Where was that at? Was it downtown in the village?
It was up in Midtown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, a little further in Midtown, like around 70th Street.
Okay.
Very, very cool club. Very hip club. He had Pink Floyd there. He had he had Charlie Green there. He had every producer, every manager that was in the area attend that show.
Wow.
And as it turns out, Chris Blackwell fell in love with the band. And, you know, back then, Chrisless Records. So he loved us. And I should back up a little bit. When Sue first started, we signed a contract with a manager named Barry Wolf.
All right.
And it was a 10-year contract. He had put a lot of money into the band, equipment and pictures, truck, a bunch of things. But he couldn't help the band. He had us sign with two producers that weren't the right guys at all. They were more of pop kind of producers, and we were not pop. And we weren't happy with the producing, and we weren't happy with his management. So when Chris Blackwell wanted us, oh, yeah, we wanted to sign.
Right.
Chris would not sign us unless we got out of the contract with Barry Wolf. So Chris finally said, look, I'll tell you, I'll do something I never do. He said, I'll take 15%. He gets to take it 25%. He said, I'll take 15% instead of 25, and we'll give Barry Wolf 10%. But he has to sign a clause that he has nothing to do with handling the band.
Right.
long story short, Barry Wolf would not do that. Mm. At that point, I was 28 years old. I had enough money to put a down payment on a house, and Salvation made me an offer. It was a stable, get your paycheck every week kind of thing.
Right, right.
And I said, you know what? I'm going to join Salvation, and then I'm going to sit this 10 years out.
Yeah.
And that's what I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's
so now we start with Salvation.
Now you start with Salvation, and you got married.
And I got married. Yeah.
Well, how long was the 10-year contract for? When did you sign it? How old were you?
I signed it a year before that, so it was 1968 when we signed the contract. So I had to wait until 78 until that's what I did.
Okay.
Yeah. And then joined Salvation. Salvation was a really unique thing for me. It was totally different. It was a party band with some very talented guys in it. But there were a couple of guys that I didn't think I would want to play with. So I told them I would join if they took two of my guys. They were six pieces at that point.
Okay.
And I wanted my bass player and my keyboard player, and they agreed.
Okay.
So we joined the band, the three of us. And I knew what I was stepping into. The other guys really didn't. These guys were... They weren't married. They didn't have any ties to, you know, their lives were still wide open, and they couldn't take the top 40 kind of, you know, play what the people want kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It was hard for me to take it too, but now I was married. It was that or, you know, who knows, you know, get a job or something.
Yeah.
So I'd rather be a musician. And
sure.
I stayed with it, but the other two guys left after a short period, about a year. And they were replaced by really, really good guys. I mean, Salvation had a couple of Juilliard cats in it. And, you know, the band had significant talent. But they had two front men. They were the key to our success, really. They were funny guys. And one of the guys was an outrageous front man. I never saw anybody like him till today. I mean, this guy would climb into the ceiling once. And we had a 100-foot cord for him. And he's still singing, and he disappears into the ceiling. All of a sudden, about 50 feet out, he comes crashing through onto all the people, all dirt and dust and shit, come out of the ceiling, and he's still singing, hanging onto some beam up there, you know?
Sounds like my kind of guy.
Yeah, oh, he was, man. He would bend over the bar backwards, and two bartenders would take two bottles of Dewar's and pour it straight down his throat. I mean, he didn't swallow. It went right down, and you'd listen to it. And he'd get up, and he'd go, Saturday night, and it'd be like Monday, you know?
That's awesome.
But the people loved that, you know?
Yeah, sure, sure.
And another part of their shtick was they got the audience to sing along.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big winner for us. Getting audience participation is, you know, if you want to make money, that's one of the quickest and easiest ways to do it in a bar band.
Right, right. Get people involved.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Let's go back a little bit. Band of Gypsies.
Yeah.
You played with them?
Well, I opened for them.
Well, you opened for them.
On the ship that goes around Manhattan, the boat that goes around Manhattan.
And, Circle Line?
It was one of those lines. I don't remember which one, but it was sponsored by Q104, whatever the hot rock station was.
Okay.
We were sort of their house or their boat band.
Boat band? Yeah. House boat band?
Anyway, they asked me, Band of Gypsies asked me to join.
Oh, okay.
And I wanted to do it. You know, I wanted to do it. But then again, it was one of these deals where you work sometimes and then you don't work. And I was now in Yasker's Farm, and Yasker's Farm was making a lot of money, and we were doing real well. But worse than that, I'm not going to say which guy, but one of the guys from Band of Gypsies, wife sort of controlled things, and she was really hard to deal with, and that turned me off big time.
That was Hendrix's band, right, Jimmy?
Yeah.
Hendrix.
Oh, yeah,
that,
Jimmy's
right?
band. Yeah, yeah, it was Buddy Miles and... Billy Cox.
Okay.
And they wanted me in the band. I did a lot of Hendrix and Salvation.
Yeah, yeah.
That was my contribution
right.
To Salvation. I love Hendrix and I loved playing it, you know, so that went real well. And they liked what I did. And I'm not going to say which guy's wife it was, but it was one of those guys. And the other guy really had some kind of drug problem, too.
Yeah.
And I could tell over the phone and stuff. Right, you know, right. I sent him some tapes of songs that he did. He had hits with these songs, and I rearranged them. I did one in 12/8, and I like doing different time signatures, sure. And it impressed him, and he was hot to do it, but the stars just didn't line up, right. You know.
You had Yazgers at the time, too.
Yes,
so,
I did.
Yeah, so you were happy there.
Yeah. I wanted to go home to my wife every night. I got another offer from, I can't think of his name. I'm so bad with names, you know. What happened just the other day? You know, the guy that wrote I'm Already Gone? I'm Already Gone.
Oh, the Eagles?
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. But he,
Glenn
they
Fry?
Didn't write it. No. What's his name wrote
Henley?
It?
Henley? Who? Don Henley?
No, he wasn't in the Eagles.
No.
He got hits on his own.
Randy Meisner, maybe?
No. Everybody knows this guy in the world. I just can't think of his name. I'll think of it before the interview's over.
Yeah.
We'll get it.
But our sound man in Salvation moved to California and got hooked up with Rose Butler, who was in this guy's band. What is his name? And they were touring through New Jersey anyway. And he brought her to see Salvation, and she really liked the way I played, and she invited him out, and he really liked the way I played, and they asked me to join. But it was another one of these where you get $1,500 a night for about, I don't know, 2 months, and then you're off for the next 10 months, you know? Right. And I moved to California and all this stuff, and I just really wasn't into that, so... So I didn't take that. You know, I wanted to go home, be with my kids, keep my kids stable in the same schools and stuff. And
that
was the other
good
offer
that,
I had.
Yeah.
Also, Felix Cavalier asked me to join his band more than once. He wanted me to do one of these television shows. I don't know, Shindig, or it was some show back then that was a big television show. And I couldn't do that because I was with Salvation at that point, and they didn't want me to even take off a night to go fly to California to do it, so I didn't do it.
Yeah. Jackson Brown? Is that who?
Jackson Brown! Jackson Brown!
Cell phone.
And, you know, and the other thing about Jackson Brown's band, I was really the wrong guy for the band.
Yeah.
You know, he liked the way I played, but I guess he didn't see that I was not the guy. The guy they had was great, and he was real country. Oriented.
They had David Lindley. He's the guy who did all those slide stuff.
I wouldn't be able to cut that gig, you know?
Wow.
So
that's something.
But it was nice to know, you know?
Sure.
That Jackson Brown wanted you in his
band. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Who? Anybody else you played with that we might know? Or?
Another guy that wanted me was Curtis Knight. Hendrix did an album with Curtis Knight.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, he asked me to do a band with him as well.
Wow.
When I was in Salvation, yeah. Like I said, once I got married and children and stuff, I was comfortable. I was making really good money.
Right.
And my wife worked for Eastern Airlines as a, she was a vacation planner.
Okay.
Because of that, we got free air tickets, we got free hotels,
sweet.
We got free car rentals,
nice.
And we were both making money, and we went on these, Salvation took two vacations a year, 2 weeks a year, and, you know, I was living like a superstar. Mm. I remember once we stayed in Acapulco at this place called Las Brisas, which has a private swimming pool for each cottage.
Wow.
And you can't see. Nobody could see. You could do anything you want in there, and nobody could see you. It was
cool.
So that private. But the doors were open one day, and the next cottage next to me, and there was Skunk Baxter.
Oh, yeah?
Right next to me.
Right next to you?
Yeah.
Did you guys play?
No, we didn't talk. I don't think he liked the idea that I was peeking through. I couldn't help it. I just walked by, and there he was in the pool, and I could see right through, you know?
I thought I smelled a skunk. I don't know.
Exactly.
Or he might have been smoking some skunk, right?
Yeah, I was down, and I smelled some us.
Oh, that's great, man. Oh, fun stuff. Joe wants to talk about your guitar.
Sure.
Well, he loves that thing, man.
Oh, you do, Joe? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, man. You know, I mean, my whole recollection of you was that guitar. So, you know, when we got to finally work together a couple of years ago, and that guitar, you still have it. So it's special, you know, for me anyway. You know, I mean, I'm sure it's, you know, even, you know, more special for you. So it's, what do you got there? What is that,
it's
baby?
It's a 61 Les Paul Custom. When you look at it, of course, it looks exactly like an SG. But what you have to know is that in 61, they stopped making the Les Paul, and they replaced it with this exact guitar, and they called it Les Paul Custom. The following year, they stopped. They didn't really stop calling it. They still called some of them Les Pauls, but they called the main body SG, which stood for solid body.
Right.
And they started making the regular Les Paul body again. But for 1 year only, this was the only Les Paul that it was affordable. I mean, was out for people to buy. And right. It was called Les Paul Custom. It had three gold pickups, patent applied fours, and all gold hardware with this fold-out gold vibrato bar, you know, which I found useless. You know, give it to Jeff Beck and he'll find marvelous things to do with it. You know?
How long you had that guitar?
I don't know, 50 years, 40 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So yeah,
it looks like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It absolutely does.
I watched some videos recently, there's some recent stuff. And
yeah. You know, actually, my original one was stolen. And this I replaced it with about 40 years ago.
Yeah.
But I was in the Village one night, and I was supposed to jam with some band at, I don't remember, it was a hip club down here in the Village back then. And I had a brand new car, and I left it in my trunk. I went in to just make sure that I was going to jam, the band was there, they were ready, and I didn't have to walk around with my guitar, you know. So they said, yeah, come on in. I went back outside to get my guitar. I put the key in the trunk, and the key wouldn't go in. So I got in the car, and I popped the trunk. Guitar was gone.
Mm. Somebody jammed the lock.
Oh, my God. It broke my heart. Because that particular guitar, when I first got that guitar, the necks on those are very thin. And I wanted a little more meat on it.
Yeah.
And I went to this old Italian luthier who said, I will replace the neck for you with a hard rock maple neck. And I'll put a quarter-inch steel bar in it so it never has to be adjusted.
Right.
Well, I can't tell you what that quarter-inch steel bar or that hard rock or whatever the combination was, that guitar sounded marvelous.
Oh, so that your original one was modified.
Yeah.
It had a different neck on
it.
Oh,
was.
I didn't know. Okay.
It was, and it sounded just better than any guitar I've ever played. And that was the one they stole. And when I got this one, I went back to that old guy, and he died.
Oh.
You know, I couldn't replace it, so I just play it the way it is. And I still love it more than... I don't... You know, the sound of it, I've done quite a bit of changing.
Yeah, you've modified it quite a bit.
Yeah, I've modified it quite a bit. But
what are some of the modifications you've done to it?
Well, I've changed pickups. That's basically it. One thing I do that I haven't seen anybody do is I put a Fender pickup in the middle. I put a Fender Telecaster or a Strat pickup in the middle. I change them now and then. And I have a Bill Lawrence pickup in the neck position. Not many people know Bill Lawrence pickups.
Right.
But he made a pickup that I really like, this neck pickup. And it's made with blades to pick up the sound of the strings rather than screws.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out I can play on that blade and I can get notes off of it. And those notes are like screaming high.
Yeah, man, you get like high F sharps and G's.
Yeah,
maybe
and
even
I
an
can
A
get
up
a
there.
Lot of notes, yeah, because I can bend it all the way up, you know, and it's really effective. It's so, you know, like crescendo at the end of a long solo. I hit that note at the top and it just goes through people, you know.
Yeah, it's like having like almost three octaves on that
thing.
It's
like
something
ee!
Crazy. Yeah.
I could never sing it, but it's effective, you know. People like it.
Cool.
Yeah, that guitar sounds great. It really does. I mean,
Thank you, Joe.
I'm fortunate enough to be able to record it almost every week with you up here, and it's a keeper.
Thank you. You know, hearing that does my heart good because my ears off after all these years of playing are not what they used to be, and consequently, I have a tendency to EQ a lot more highs in the guitar than most people probably want to hear. So it's nice to hear that somebody likes the sound of my guitar.
Yeah, it sounded good from what I heard.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't seen you guys play in a while. Like I said, I saw some videos. I was like, damn.
Thank you.
This guy's still smoking it, man.
Yeah.
Look at these hands. These hands are grizzled, man. They still do it. They still do it.
If you look at these hands, you look at this hand, how wrinkled it is. That's the right hand, the picking hand.
Yeah.
And the left hand is relatively not
Yeah.
And that goes a long way in saying what exercise does to the body.
Yeah.
I mean, look at how young that is compared to this one as well. Yeah.
Right, and that's just from moving those fingers.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I could convince my body to do a lot more exercise.
Yeah, well, that's the key, I guess. Let's talk about Yasgers.
Yes.
When did Yasgers start?
Okay. At the end of Salvation, I sort of just had enough of doing what the people wanted to hear. I was of the opinion at that point that just playing great songs would be enough and more than enough to bring a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
The mindset back in those days, a lot of people were smoking pot. Pot, for some reason, raises the aptitude of the listener.
Okay.
Okay? And people would come to the club, and I noticed this. We were playing at the Osprey Hotel, and the Osprey had two bands every summer. We were the headline band, but next door, the other band played, and we both played at the same time because you couldn't hear each other. And I would go next door to listen to the other band, and I noticed that the songs that were getting the most amount of applause were not the modern songs, not the new wave. New wave was happening then. It was the older songs, the songs from the 60s, mm-hmm. the real good stuff, you know? And I said, wow, it's amazing that people are really into that. So when I quit Salvation, I had the idea, let's play that music, but what can I do to tie it together with a theme? And I thought, and finally I came up with the idea, do a Woodstock band. Not a Woodstock show, per se, where we do everything that was done at Woodstock, but we do a show that is all the music from that era.
Okay.
So we represent the era rather than, you know, specific acts of the show, although we do that.
Right.
And that gave us the license, so to speak, to play all the greatest songs that my heart loved, you know, and it was really easy selling the band members on it. You know?
They loved it too.
Yeah, they did.
What year did it start? What year was
79,
that?
79. I guess I should put this in. A guy that I knew from years before that was an entrepreneur, and he was the one that convinced me to leave Salvation. I would have left anyway, but he said he would back me and the band, but he wanted us to do all originals. And I said, I think what we should do is a combination of originals and the 60s stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he would back us with money so that if we didn't work enough, they would fill whatever need we had with money. So I said, wow, it's hard to turn that down.
Sounds like a no-brainer, right?
Yeah. So as it turned out, this guy did not have the money. He had someone else that was giving him the money. And that someone else decided at one point, no more money. Very early in the project.
Right.
You know, like a month later.
That's not good.
So that's when I went to the band and said, guys, instead of that, what we can do is we could do this Woodstock thing. I really believe it'll work. And I went to Sammy Boyd, who was the big agent back then, and he bought into it. And then I wrote a commercial. And the commercial was a Cheech and Chong walking into a nightclub, and you hear Black Magic Woman playing. And Cheech says to Chong, whoa, Santana's playing here, you know? And he says, no, man, that's not Santana. That's Yasgers Farm. And Chong goes, who? And then the Who starts playing, you know? He says, Yasgers Farm, man. They play everything. They play Crosby, Stills, Nash. They play Hendrix, man. And they're going to be playing Friday night at the Hole in the Wall.
Oh, cool.
You know? Well, we go there Friday night, Hole in the Wall, line around the block.
Wow.
Just like that.
That's a good commercial.
Yeah.
I like that. I wish I would have heard that.
Yeah. It worked. It really worked. That year, I spent $75,000 on those commercials.
Wow.
I took a big chunk of all the money we made and put it right into the radio.
Hmm.
And that really turned out to be a great idea because what it did is it made us popular all over.
Yeah.
Not in just one little area. I mean, wherever that radio station reached,
who heard the commercial?
We had a crowd. And when we'd go to Pennsylvania or Connecticut, I'd call the radio station and send them the tape, and that was it. So, but the band please don't let me undersell the band. The band, no, the members were fantastic. Yeah. I got the best guys that I could have ever imagined. Dan Glass was from Memphis, Tennessee. I auditioned these guys. We put an ad in the paper, and plus through word of mouth, all the people I knew that I was auditioning players. And Ronnie Mayu, who was down here from Boston, it was the drummer. Danny Glass played, he was a multi-instrumentalist. He played keyboard, congas, and harp. And he did, and he sang like Robert Plant.
Yeah.
And he did all of those things great. Ronnie Mayu was the drummer, fantastic drummer. Dale was from Philadelphia. He was a great pianist and organ player. Mm-hmm. And then we had Frankie D'Agostino, bass, great singing bass player. Yeah. You know, Stephen Stills to the T.
Oh, wow.
So that lineup was just, you know, that was as big a reason, if not more, than all the other things combined.
Yeah.
The members of the band, you know. By the way, I'd just like to say thank you to Vicki Watson, who is our roadie and probably the best roadie I've ever had. So
now that's saying a lot. I'm sure you've had some cats in your day.
Very capable. This woman, not only does she carry the gear, she handles so much work for us. I mean, including the website and everything related to that. And she makes sure that all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, and I can count on her, and she's a very nice person, too.
There's a big shout-out to Vicki. Yo, Vicki!
Yo, Vicki!
Vicki, girl!
It's good to have somebody like that, definitely, to take care of those things, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like I said, Lenny, the legend, he can't carry his own gear, man. Come on, please. Somebody's going to carry that in for him,
I'm not able to anymore.